Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations, coast to coast and border to border here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on destroyed arguments right after this message. You know, with an income tax, or with an income, rather, of $50,000, you're paying about $7,650 in Social Security taxes. Now, that's if you're self-employed and you're paying that 15.3% self-employment tax. Well, shouldn't you subtract the $7,650 that you just paid for Social Security tax from the $50,000 and then pay your income tax on the $42,350 balance instead of paying 17% of the $50,000 a second time? But you know, the IRS makes you pay 15.3% of $50,000 in Social Security tax, and then they make you pay 17% of the same $50,000 in income tax. Now that means that you're paying 17% of that $7,650 Social Security tax twice. Now that little bookkeeping trick steals an extra $1,300 from everybody that pays that tax. What would you think if Sears, Penny's, or your credit card company charged you twice like Social Security and the IRS does? I thought you'd think that was just kind of special. Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call me here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. That's the school. You can come here to school if you'd like, or you can do the school at home. If you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine and send the email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? All right, last time we were talking about destroyed arguments by Larry Becraft. I'll give Larry Becraft the credit for this. That it's quite a little chore, you know, to prove a negative. If somebody says, "I want you to prove to me that the world is round," I guess I could do that if I put my mind to it, but I wouldn't waste the time doing it. And I'm not saying that Larry's wasting his time here. He's doing us a great service by proving these negatives, but that's the way people are. I mean, they'll write me a letter here, you know, and they say, "I want you to prove the income tax is constitutional." I wouldn't do it. Larry Becraft, well, he took the time. He said, "Okay, well, I'll take you some time. I'm going to do you a favor, and I'm going to prove to you that the income tax is constitutional." Okay? Or, "I'm going to prove to you that this tax protest scheme over here doesn't work." I've never done that. I never took the time. But when I got this from Larry, sent this to me some years back, he said, "I put this up on my website to help people to distinguish between a con and a fraud by these tax protesters and a legitimate argument." Now, there are three legitimate, I mean three court-approved defenses to an income tax charge. So as I've pointed out, the courts came up with about 2,000 arguments, and they answered 2,000 questions for people in 20 years. 1,997 of them are losers, and three of them are winners. And the moral of the story is that reliance is the defense. I relied upon the law. I relied upon my attorney. I relied upon H&R Block. And the courts have said, we don't want to put people in prison because they relied in good faith upon a paid professional that gave them bad advice. So it's called the Reliance Defense. It came out in 1932. It's called Murdoch versus U.S., I guess. Kind of forget 1932. I got it in my paperwork. Then in 1979, another kind of a little twist on Reliance came up. A guy didn't get this advice from his attorney or tax preparer. He read a book, a copyrighted book, and so he went into court. His name was Aiken, up in the First Circuit, up in New England. He said, I relied in good faith upon this book. Well, the First Circuit said, well, we don't want to lock people up in jail because they read a book and believed its contents. And so they said, well, okay, well, we'll accept that as an excuse. And so they didn't put him in jail. It doesn't mean you don't have to pay the tax or that you don't have the civil penalties, you know, and so on, but at least they're not going to put you in jail. Now, there's a third defense over here. It's called religious free exercise. Third defense. The Amish use that quite often. They don't pay the income tax because they're exempted, because they have a religious objection to it. So they don't pay, for instance, the Social Security tax. So if you're an Amish man and you don't have, of course, if you're Amish, you're not listening to me right now, but then if you were Amish, you wouldn't be paying your income tax because you don't have a Social Security number. You're opposed to Social Security, you don't have a Social Security number, and you don't pay the Social Security tax. Well, you don't have to be Amish to drop out of Social Security. You have to get rid of the number. You got to resign your commission there. And the Amish aren't eligible for Social Security, or at least those that don't have a Social Security number aren't, and therefore they don't have to pay the tax. Well, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out if you'd stop having income, then you wouldn't have to pay the income tax. See how simple that is? If you don't buy gasoline, you don't have to pay the gasoline tax. And if you don't own any real estate, you don't have to pay any real estate or property tax. See how simple that is? It's a choice that you make. Now, judges pay the income tax because they have income. They want to be judges, and they want that job, and they want that income, and then they have a corresponding duty. They got to pay the income tax. If you didn't want to pay the income tax, judge, why don't you resign your judgeship and go out and go to work like the rest of us? It's just a wild new idea, you know. People want to work for General Motors, and they want income. In fact, if you'll ask people, they want more income next year than they got this year. In fact, they work real hard to get promotions. I looked at that one day and I said, well, let's see what happens here. I remember when I was a youngster, I was out working hard for International Harvester, and they were paying me union scale, $3.27 an hour. God, I thought I'd arrived. I thought the millennium was here. I thought Jesus had returned and we were all living in heaven. I had seniority, you know, and I had a good job and worked 8 hours a day and got everything's going good. Now, of course, out of my $3.27 an hour, I had to pay some taxes. So I had what was known as take-home pay. You ever heard that term, take-home pay? $127 a week. So what was I making here? I was making $3.27, $3.27 times 40 hours a week. Wouldn't let you work over 40 hours. So I was making $130.80. Is that right? Let me do that one again. 3.27 times 40. Yeah, that's $130.80. Well, that doesn't come out right. I got my numbers mixed up. I'm going to back off of that. I'll work out those numbers, and next time I'll tell you what the answer was. But anyway, I got a take-home pay, $127, and maybe I was getting less than that, but I thought it was $127 a week, take-home pay. Now, if I worked overtime, once in a while you'd get a couple of 3 hours of overtime, they would pay you time and a half. So instead of $3.27 an hour, I'm getting, you know, $4.50 plus. But instead of getting my $127, I'd only get $125 or $120 or $21 or $22 or something like that. What was happening here? Well, it boosts you up into a higher tax bracket. Higher tax bracket is what you get. Now, of course, at the end of the year, after you've taken all your deductions, you know, it evens out. Of course, the government takes this interest-free. They don't pay you any interest on your money. They take your money, they pay you no interest. If you owe them money, they make you pay them interest. Didn't seem very fair to me. Of course, government doesn't have to be fair. They're the only game in town. So, I started to think about that, and I said, gee, we want to make more and more money, but when we make more and more money, it puts us in a higher tax bracket. That's that second plank to the Communist Manifesto. See, that's that heavy progressive income tax. Heavy progressive income tax. I've mentioned that a few times. If you're making $50,000 a year, they take about 20. If you make $100,000 a year, they take about 75. Got that? Double your productivity, and they'll let you keep an extra 8% of it. They'll take the other 94. Well, I looked at that and I said, well, it looks like to me that making more and more money isn't the answer to this problem. Americans want to make more money. If you make $50,000 this year, you want to make 60 next. If you make 60 next year, you want to make 70 the year after. Keeps putting you in higher and higher tax brackets, and you're getting less and less. You get a few extra dollars, but the government makes more. You get a 10% raise, and the government gets a 90% raise. I looked at that, and I said, I don't like that program, and I'm going to opt out. Well, a lot of other people took a look at that program. They said it's unfair, so they don't opt out. They stay in, but then they don't pay the tax. They come up with some reason why. So I mentioned to you that Larry B. Craft here has put together a number of destroyed arguments, issues, arguments that have been raised in court as a defense to paying the income tax. Another popular argument Larry goes on to describe for us, currently circulating, is that a mere notice of levy is not equal to a levy and thus may not be used for tax collection purposes. Well, the courts have not accepted this idea. And in United States versus Island, E-I-L-A-N-D, cited at 223 Fed 2nd, 118, and in Rosenblum versus United States, cited at 300 Fed 2nd, 843, and United States versus Pittman, 449 Fed 2nd, 623. Now, that's three cases out of six that he has cited here. The courts have rejected the idea that a notice of levy is not equal to a levy. The courts haven't accepted the idea. Perhaps there are some remaining methods to prevail on this argument, but serious damage has already been done. Now, what Larry is saying there, serious damage has been done, is that every time you go into court and you get an appellate review of your case, you're building a brick wall. So if you go in and you argue that case poorly or incorrectly, the court will give you the correct answer to your incorrect question. So if you want to set case law, make case precedent, you have to ask the right question to get the right answer. If you ask the wrong question, the court will give you the right answer to your wrong question, and now you've built a brick wall that the rest of us have to climb over, and oftentimes it's pretty poor. Now, that's why the government, the Justice Department, they're pretty crafty people there at the Justice Department. If they want to set case law or make case precedent, they wait until there's a case that comes along that's ripe. The Supreme Court does this. It's called the ripeness doctrine. And you'll hear that word or that term used in cases. This case is not ripe for adjudication. But of course, lay people like us, you know, we're desperate, aren't we? I mean, the IRS is after us. They got a criminal indictment. And so we come up with these these Pollyanna type defenses, desperate defenses. And we go in and we argue the case incorrectly, or we argue the case incompletely. We fail to bring up the right issues. And this is one of them. That's why Larry points this out. He says, you know, perhaps there are some remaining methods on this levy. If you'd ask the right question concerning levies, we might be able to prevail. But you go in here and you ask the question off point, out of context, improperly, poorly thought out. The court gives you the answer, builds a brick wall. And actually, the tax protest movement has done more to solidify the income tax in America than any other movement, any other thing the government could have done. Where there were some legitimate constitutional questions concerning the income tax, they have now been removed by inappropriate questions being asked of the appellate courts and brick walls being built that we can no longer climb over. So we didn't do ourselves any big favors, but then the lawyers weren't doing us any big favors anyway. It was the lawyers and the government that got us into this mess, and so we couldn't say no. FDR came along during the Depression years and he said, I've got a solution to the problem. Follow me. In desperation, we followed FDR. And look where it got us. Let's take a look around. $149 trillion in debt. That's not all government debt, but it's partly government debt. So we've been following after all of these Pied Pipers, these tax protesters. They gave us 1099 forms to file against government agencies and codicils to wills and land patents and notice of levy. And now the hot thing is called this UCC argument. UCC. Larry Beecraft has it as number 9 here. He said back in the early 90s, a guy by the name of Hartford Van Dyke promoted the theory that commercial law was the foundation for all law around the world. And based upon Hartford's contention regarding commercial law, he developed the idea that an affidavit of truth submitted in commerce could create a lien which simply had to be paid. Well, Hartford Van Dyke claimed that his findings were well known everywhere and that his lien, or this lien process, had been used for thousands of years. So I obtained his memo regarding this argument, and I went to the law library. God, what a novel idea. So Larry Beecraft went to the law library with this memo from a fellow named Hartford Van Dyke. His contention that this principle manifested itself in the law was wrong. I could find nothing which supported this argument. This theory was a complete fabrication. Let me pause right here and let's think about this. Hartford Van Dyke. I never heard of the guy until I read it here. But this is another one of these tax protest schemes. And when one of these comes up, he goes out and he sells this and he starts making money. Then a bunch of other tax protesters see this other guy over here, their competitors, making money with this idea. So they can't take the exact same idea. They've got to modify it. So they come along with some modifications to this idea, and they go out and sell it to their followers and so on. And then, I mean, if you take a look at this UCC argument, and I've had students come in here, and they tell me conflicting stories. And that's because the UCC argument that comes out of this patriot group over here or out of another patriot group over there has to have some differences to it. And so they just fabricate these differences. Now, the laws come out of your political process. They come out of your state legislature. They come out of the Congress of the United States. And then the executive branch enforces those laws. That's why the highway patrolman is out there giving you a ticket for not buckling your seatbelt. It's the judicial process that levies the penalties for the violation of these laws that you got out of your political process. Now, if this law violates your constitutional rights, your due process rights, then the court will declare it to be unconstitutional. And that's what these people are trying to do. They're trying to come up with a way to show that the income tax is unconstitutional or that this law doesn't apply to me. And so these various groups go out and sell this the way they make their living. I mean, they could go out and get an honest job and pay taxes and pay their bills like everybody else. But, you know, there's people that sell siding. There's people that go out and defraud people, and there are contractors. You know, I'm an old-timey general contractor, and there are contractors that go out there and sign contracts with people, take their money, and then they don't perform. They don't perform. And they steal these people's money. Well, it makes it look bad for all the rest of us other contractors that are out there that are honest, legitimate businessmen. I never cheated anybody out of a dime. But boy, did I have a lot of problem making sales to people who did have contractors steal from them. You can't hardly blame them, can you? So here are these tax protesters. They're running around stealing from you, and then the government's running around stealing from you. I can understand your dilemma. You got these thieves out here stealing from you. So I guess it's up to you to educate yourself to what the hell's going on in life, isn't it? That's why I opened a law school. I said, well, if you want to learn law, let me show it to you. Let me teach it. Well, Larry Becraft went to law school, so he learned law. Well, one of the things that you have to know in law is how to do legal research, so that when a subject matter comes up, you know where to go to get the answer. And, of course, the law library is the place to do that. So he looked it up in the literature. Here's a guy comes along and says, well, here's what we're going to do. Well, that's what I do. I look it up in the literature and I find out, and that's what Larry's doing here, and he's citing the cases out of the literature that says that doesn't work. The courts aren't going to buy into that. Now, you may believe it, like a codicil to a will. I had a guy and his wife in here. I mean, my God, these people were so mad they left school. They just said, we're not going to listen to this crap. You're nuts, Gordon. Well, then later, he didn't go to jail, but he was later prosecuted, and they lost a lot of money in the process. He didn't go to jail, but when they came after him, they, I don't know if they took their house or, but he had to pay the taxes. And I'm just pointing out to you that you might as well pay the tax today rather than pay the tax plus a 60% penalty plus interest and go to jail or something on that order. Now, this Hartford Van Dyke, he probably believed his story, but his story wasn't true. Maybe he knew that his story was a lie. Well, in that case, then he's just a damn criminal fraud, isn't he? See, fraud comes in two forms. You've got actual fraud and constructive fraud. An actual fraud is where I lie to you. And I know that I'm lying to you, and I'm lying to you on purpose so that I can deceive you. That's called an actual fraud. Then there's a constructive fraud. That's where I lie to you. But I don't know that I'm lying to you because I actually believe my own lie. I believe that what I'm telling you is the truth. That's called a constructive fraud. But the bottom line is you're still lied to and you're still deceived and you still suffer the penalty. You know, I've often said that I thought that Erwin Schiff actually believes his own BS. I think he actually believes what he's teaching, what he's promoting. On the other hand, there are others out there, like Roger Elvick. In my view, I think the guy knows that it's BS, and he sells it to make money. And he's been to jail more than once. I met the guy a couple of times. Kind of a religious guy. I wasn't too impressed with him, to be honest with you. But thousands of people are, and many of those people go to jail in the process. So this UCC argument now, which is the rage. I mean, everybody is involved in this UCC and straw men, and I don't know, I couldn't understand it. It's beyond me. And when people come in here to tell me about it and promote it and one thing and another, I get a different story from every one of them. I haven't had the same story come out of two people's mouths concerning this UCC argument and straw men. Well, did other people act upon Hartford Van Dyke's ideas anyway? And the answer is yes. Leroy Schweitzer of the Montana Freeman, took Hartford's ideas to heart and claimed that he created liens against public officials. And based upon these liens, Leroy started issuing site drafts drawn upon some post office account and then started passing them out to many gullible people who believed that such drafts were required to be paid by the feds. And not only did Leroy Schweitzer get into deep trouble, so did many who got drafts from him. There have been lots of people who have been prosecuted, convicted, and jailed for using these site drafts allegedly justified by this theory. Now, one of the most recent prosecutions of someone for using one of Leroy's drafts is Pete Stern. He's a patriot from North Carolina. Well, several years ago, Pete issued some of these drafts to the IRS. Pete has been one of the most vocal advocates of the UCC argument. We are Brits, nom de guerre, and so on. Well, I like Pete, but still he has followed some crazy arguments. Pete's federal criminal case is filed in the Western District of North Carolina, and you can visit the clerk's webpage. Now, once you get to this page, you look at the left side of the page to the sidebar, and you click on this case information section called Docket Image. And when that page comes up, insert Pete's case number, and it puts the case number in here. It's 2-1999-CRIMINAL-00081. And then his name. And his file will come up, and you can read all of the pleadings. Is he using, for his own defense, the arguments that he advocates? No. As best as I can tell, this popular UCC argument has its origins in Hartford's work and the improvements made by Leroy Schweitzer. The UCC argument is one of the most legally baseless ideas that I have ever encountered. Let me read that to you again. This UCC argument is one of the most legally baseless ideas that I've ever encountered. Now, that's Larry Beecraft. He's an attorney. Now, I'm a lawyer. In fact, Larry Beecraft is a lawyer. He's called an attorney at law. I practice pro se litigation. I don't represent other people. I just represent myself. I'm like a do-it-yourself plumber. You know, I'm not a real plumber. No, I'm a general contractor by trade, and I'm a plumber by trade. I used to be a licensed general contractor and a licensed plumber and a licensed boiler and heating contractor. And I like to tell people, you know, see, I'm not a licensed plumber. So, see, I'm not a real plumber. You have to be licensed to be a real plumber. Well, Larry Beecraft is a real lawyer. He's licensed. And in most people's minds, you can't be a plumber unless you're licensed. See, you couldn't be a teacher unless you're licensed. You have to have this government approval to know anything. You have to be licensed. And to be licensed, you have to have government approval. I don't subscribe to that crap at all. You know, Thomas Edison had over 1,200 patents. He didn't have any licenses. He only went to the third grade. The concept that you have to go to college and get a degree so that you can get a license, and if you don't have this license or degree from college, you can't know anything, I think, is just BS. But then, you know, there are people out there that hold to a different view. You got to have a degree from college. Well, this guy, Larry Beecraft, got a degree from college. And he's a licensed lawyer. And his conclusion is, this is a crazy theory. He says, it's one of the most baseless arguments that I have ever encountered in my life. Now, I'm just little Georgie Gordon. All I'd run is a little private law school over here. I'm not a real lawyer. I don't have a license. I came to the same conclusion. It's just crap. I can't understand it, but then I don't have a degree from college. I guess that's why I can't understand it. But this licensed lawyer, he doesn't understand it either. Hang on, I got to take a little break here and pay the rent. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, a $10 pizza has a 38% tax on it, and a Budweiser six-pack has a 43% tax, and if you buy a bottle of Jack Daniel's whiskey, you're paying 72% of the price of that bottle of Jack Daniel's is tax. Now, governments tax all of us, and they tax everything that wiggles, moves, or squirms. We all know that. But what is it that the government is doing to produce, prepare, or deliver, for which the government gets paid 38% for a pizza, 43% for a beer, or 72% for a drink? Does the pizza parlor guy make 38% profit on his pizza that he has to buy the ingredients to make, prepare it, cook it, serve it, and then pay rent on the store that you sit in to eat it? Does he make 38% profit? Well, why is it that the government gets paid more in taxes than the people who actually produce, prepare, and deliver the goods and the services that you and I buy? Now, if you'd like to have more information about tax and status, why don't you call me here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package and let me tell you some answers. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, my school, the Tax and Status School, is available on compact disc for adult home education. We'll teach you. We'll train you right there in your own home. If you're online, you can go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. You can do that right now before you forget it. GeorgeGordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about this thing called the UCC argument. It's the rage right now. I mean, everybody's involved in this. All tax protesters are. Many, many students come in here and I tell them, well, I think it's nonsense. And then, of course, in my tax school, this little story that I'm giving you right here, this is about a 30-page article here that Larry Beecraft wrote, is one of the subjects that we talk about. And I show my students in here, well, you know, other people have tested this and didn't work for them. What makes you think it's going to work for you? These Montana Freemen, remember that Montana Freemen standoff up there? They about, I don't know, a month or two, they're up there fighting with the IRS and fighting with the FBI and they were armed and dangerous. Hell, all those people were arrested. They were finally convicted and put in jail. Now, if that's what you want out of life, well, you know, get after it. That's the way to do it. Hell, just do what they did, and I'm sure that the FBI will come right out there, grab you and lock you up and put you in jail. Well, I looked at that and I said, well, that doesn't sound like much of a future to me. You know, I don't like the income tax any more than you do. I didn't create the income tax. I didn't make it. It was already in full force and effect when little Georgie Gordon got on the scene back in 1939. When I came in, it was already there. Paper money was already there. I looked at paper money, and I think our founding fathers came to the right conclusion. They rejected the income tax. They rejected paper money. They rejected democracy. They gave us a republic, they gave us gold and silver coin, and they financed government out of import and export taxes. And they did not believe in free trade, and they did not participate in free trade at all. Now, Americans decided what we want in America is free trade. And we got it, and now they're exporting your jobs to India. That's free trade. Ross Perot told you that in 1992. Do you remember that? Can you remember that far back, boys and girls? 1992, Ross Perot. That little guy from Texas, you know, with the big ears. And has several billion dollars. He was running for president that year. And he said, boys and girls, let me tell you about NAFTA and GATT and free trade. And Americans listened to Ross Perot, and they said, we're going to reject you, Ross. What we're going to do is we're going to vote for Bill Clinton. We want NAFTA and GATT. Well, okay, now you got it. Now listen to people, bitch. My old granny had an old adage. She said, you know, you made your bed, sweetheart, and I'll go sleep in it. And I don't feel sorry for Americans at all. You voted for Bill Clinton. That's who you wanted, and now you got him. You got GATT and you got NAFTA. Fortunately, little Georgie Gordon doesn't participate in income and income tax. So my job is not being exported to India. fortunately for me. I got out of that, and I advocate that you get out of it. But, you know, that's a choice for you to make. Larry Beecraft over here says, hey, I don't think this makes any sense, and I'm telling you about the people that have tested it. Now, as best as I can tell, this popular UCC argument, this is Larry Beecraft, he says, as best I can tell, this UCC argument has its origins in Hartford's work and the improvements made by Leroy Schweitzer of the Montana Freeman. The UCC argument is one of the most legally baseless ideas I've ever encountered, and yet organizations like Right Way Law and people like Jack Smith and Rick Schramm continue to promote this baseless poppycock. Now, here are some published cases which have correctly rejected this lunacy. And then I have people come in here, you ever heard of Right Way Law? They'll ask me, and I say, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I've heard of them. Well, what do you think of them? You know, if I come on the air and I say to you, well, that's just lunacy, it's nonsense over here. See, that's sour grapes, isn't it? They're competitors. And these people say, well, you know that George Gordon, he's as dumb as a box of rocks, and he's a deceiver and a liar, and he's this and he's that and another thing and so on. And so I try to stay out of the fray. I just say, well, hell, I'm not going to sit here and argue with these fools. I just tell people plainly, hey, listen, if you want to practice this UCC crap, get after it. Don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. Go out there and give it a try. Test it. Find out how it works. Now, let me share with you a little something here. I try to do what the winners do, and I avoid what the losers do. That's my opinion. Do what the winners do, avoid what the losers do. So I've been watching these losers, and so has Larry Beecraft. And in Jones versus City of Little Rock, cited at 314 Arkansas 383, a state case, in reference to traffic tickets, the court stated the Uniform Commercial Code does not apply to any of these offenses. In United States versus Stockland, 848 Fed Supplement 1521, UCC rejected. In Barcroft versus State, 881 Southwest 2nd, 838, Texas Appellate Court, 1994. They said, first, the UCC is not applicable to criminal proceedings. It applies to commercial transactions. United States versus Green Street, 912 Fed Supplement 224, Northern District of Texas, 1996, also raised the flag and common law court issues. In that case, United States versus Andra, 923 Fed Supplement 157, District Court of Idaho, 1996. The complaint filed by the plaintiff is not a negotiable instrument, and the Uniform Commercial Code is not, or is rather, inapplicable. It's not applicable in this case. You know, I could go on and on here. I'm not going to bore you to death. This UCC argument is nothing but an expansion or an extension of Hartford Van Dyke's theory. And since Hartford never cited any law to support his idea, people who believe this nonsense started looking for anything to support the argument. To support this contention about commercial law, the advocates of this position have relied upon the case of Erie Railroad versus Tompkins at 304 U.S. 64, decided in 1938. However, I just simply ask you to read this case, Erie Railroad v. Tompkins, and determine for yourself whether it supports the proposition of these advocates. I'd tell you to do the same thing. It doesn't have anything to do with it. It's one of the craziest things that I've observed in my years as a pro se litigant and a law teacher. People will read something, and it's kind of like the Bible. You know, preachers will read something out of the Bible, and then they will come to a conclusion and advocate that. I pointed that out to you last week. We were talking about heaven. Elijah was taken up to heaven. And so they take that statement, Elijah was taken up to heaven, and they use that as the basis of their doctrine that heaven is the reward of the saved. And the statement about Elijah being taken up to heaven doesn't have anything to do with going to heaven or heaven being the reward of the saved. And all of us have gone to heaven. We've all been taken up into heaven. Just like Elijah. Elijah was taken up into heaven in a whirlwind in a chariot by God. Now, I haven't had that experience, but I've been taken up into heaven by United Airlines and Frontier Airlines a number of times. And they always brought me back down to earth. Just like Elijah was brought back down to earth in another location. And I showed you last time when we were talking about heaven, about how he wrote a letter back to Elisha 20 years later. He was a school teacher. Elijah and Elisha were operating a college in Jerusalem, training the prophets. It was called a school for the prophets. They were training them in law. It's a law school. Just like this one. It's a law school. That's because the Bible is a law book. Well, people will cite cases out of the U.S. Supreme Court reports that are totally off point. They don't have anything to do with the subject matter that we're discussing. And the way they get away with it is because you people out there, you don't go check them out. You're not going to go read Erie Railroad. I'll just tell you right now. None of you people listening to me right now are ever going to go look up Erie Railroad and go read it. And for the two of you that want to challenge me on that, it's Erie, E-R-I-E, Railroad Company versus Tompkins, T-O-M-P-K-I-N-S. Cited at 304 U.S. 64. 304 U.S. 64. Decided in 1938. Beecraft said, I just ask you, go read the damn case. See what it's got to do with the UCC. Straw men. Income tax or anything else. Just nonsense. Now, Erie Railroad's good law. Erie Railroad is a case that was decided. Erie Railroad means what it says and says what it means. But it doesn't have anything to do with the Uniform Commercial Code and income tax. So he goes on to say, my advice is that if you hear anyone making some argument about the UCC, you want to run away as fast as you can. The argument's crazy. All right, let's take a look at number 10. The CFR, Cross-Reference Index. The Code of Federal Regulations contains a separate volume which lists various statutes and regulations which implement those statutes. This particular publication is not an exclusive list, nor is it an admission made by the government that there are no regulations for Title 26 USC. Parties making this argument have suffered defeat. The CFR Cross-Reference Index. I don't know what that is. I never heard of that before. I never heard of it. But evidently, some tax protesters out there have made this argument. Larry Beecraft said, well, let's look it up and see how many cases have come into court arguing the CFR cross-reference index. And the answer is 5 cases. Five. United States versus Cochran, 985 Fed 2nd, 1027. Russell versus United States, 95 CCH tax cases. It's 50029 Western District of Michigan, 1994. That's a tough one to find. Let me see if I can give you an easier one. Here's a tax court case, Reese versus CIR. I don't know what the CIR is. Must be Internal Revenue, I guess. C stands for something. IR, I would say, Internal Revenue. 69 TCM 2814, Tax Court Memo 1995-244. That's a tax court case. This and several other arguments described as legalistic gibberish. The tax court called it legalistic gibberish. That's what I've observed a lot. Tax protesters come in using legal words and terms. Legal words and terms that are off point and out of context. And it's gibberish because it would be like me just taking 10 Spanish words and trying to beguile you by using those Spanish words. I don't know what they mean. I don't know anything else about the Spanish language, and I don't speak Spanish, but I can use these 10 Spanish words, and so I just liberally use them here and there. Well, now, I could probably impress you. Wow, that guy Gordon, he really knows Spanish. Hey, listen to him, he can really speak a foreign language. Now, anybody that speaks Spanish would know that I was stupid. No, anybody that speaks Spanish would just start speaking Spanish and I'd just look at them with a blank stare. And that's what happens with these tax protesters. They walk into court and they start talking law to a judge. And the judge just looks at him in stark disbelief. He says, "What in the hell are you talking about, boy? What's coming out of your mouth?" "Well, I'm talking law." The judge sits there, "Yeah, I can hear these legal words. I can hear these Spanish words coming out of your mouth, but they don't say anything and they don't mean anything." And that's where these tax protesters are. Well, at least that's been my experience. A couple other cases here. Now, this is the CFR cross-reference index. Now, I never came across that, at least not yet. So I don't know what that's all about here, but BCRAFT says it's been used, and tax court says it's legalistic gibberish. Number 11, BCRAFT goes on, he's got the flag issue. You've probably heard about this flag issue. And there's a real story behind that. That fringed flag up there is, in fact, an admiralty flag. What if you walked into court and or into some other government office and they were flying the Confederate flag? I mean, down in the South, a lot of state governments down there, at least they used to have the Confederate flag. Now listen, the Confederacy has been dead since Appomattox Courthouse in 1865. I mean, you know, it's an old-timey government that used to exist years and years ago, but doesn't exist anymore. And they still fly that flag down in some states in the South. At least the last I heard, there was still a couple of them that were still flying the Confederate flag. So what? What if you walked into a courtroom and they got a communist Chinese flag in there? So what? What if they got a Confederate flag? So what? What does it do? Well, a currently popular argument is that the gold-fringed flag indicates the admiralty jurisdiction of the court. And naturally, pro ses have made this argument, and they have lost. All right, now watch this. You walk into court. Now, what are you charged with? Well, you're charged with speeding. So in your defense, you say, or you write a motion to dismiss, because the flag's got a fringe on it. What's that got to do with you speeding? Well, this isn't a proper court. Why not? I mean, you might as well walk in there and say, "Well, Judge, you've got blonde hair." So what? Or you could walk in there and say, "Well, the judge is black." So? What difference does that make? That's why I'm pointing out to you that these arguments have been actually raised by people, and I'm sure that they were sincere people. I'm not making fun of you. If you walked in and you made this flag issue and you lost or somebody made fun of you or something, I understand your dilemma. You believed it. That fringed flag is improper. To have the Chinese communist flag in the traffic court would be improper. But that's not the subject matter. Now, let's suppose that you've got an improper process going on. You know, you walk into the court and you say to the judge, "Well, I'd like to have a jury trial." And the judge says, "Well, you ain't getting a jury trial here." I had this happen to me one time. I walked in Judge Woods and I said, "I demand a jury trial." And he says, "You ain't getting a jury trial here." He signed the damn ticket and he said, "Hand it to me." He said, "Go pay the fine." That's called a denial of due process and equal protection of the law. Violates the 14th Amendment, by the way. So I took the issue into a higher court and I prevailed against Judge Woods. There is a remedy. When a judge or when some public official, when some government agency does something to you that they shouldn't do to you, or they don't do something for you that they're supposed to do for you, there's a remedy for that. There's something you can do about them. It's called appeal, or a writ of mandamus, or a writ of prohibition, or a writ of certiorari, or, you know, there's remedies out there. Some of them are extraordinary remedies, they're called. Some of them are ordinary remedies, like an appeal, pretty ordinary remedy. And you can solve your problem, but you don't solve your problem with this legal gibberish. That's my point. Walking in and arguing that the flag's got a fringe on it because the policeman gave you a ticket for speeding, and maybe the speeding ticket's incorrect. Then you need to defend the speeding ticket correctly. If the IRS brings an action against you, which I was afraid they were going to do to me when I got that 1099 form from this guy, I took the bull by the horns. I went into the IRS before the IRS contacted me. I just walked in and said, look, let me show you something here. I received this in the mail from this company. This is a fraud, and I want you to investigate it, and I want you to give me a remedy. They did. The IRS solved my problem. I don't know what they did, but they took care of it. I never heard from them again. I never got a notice from the IRS that says, hey, you didn't file your tax return for 1998. Hey, you need to come in here and file and pay your taxes on this $123,000 this guy claims that he paid. Now, if I hadn't done that, I think I would have got a letter from him, and then I'd be behind the power curve, and then I'd have to go in there and show him that I didn't work for that company. And you know, you just build a mountain or make a mountain out of a molehill. And that's what's going on here. You walk into court and you got a speeding ticket and you end up getting put in jail for contempt of court or something because of an incorrect idea. That's why I operate a law school. It's for the purpose of training you in doing legal research, for instance. You know, if you people could just walk into the law library and pick up the book that you need to explain to you, here's the way this works, it would solve about 99% of your legal problems. It would solve your legal questions. I'm conducting a school here this week. I have students here that and yesterday we went through legal research. It just wipes the cobwebs right out of your brain. The number one thing that you all must learn to do is do legal research so you can find the answer. If you could find the answer to this, that'd be it, wouldn't it? Now, there's only 30 answers here. Now, remember, there's 2,000 of these legal arguments that have been expressed or expounded on income tax in the 21-year period between 1964 and 85. 2,000. Well, I'm not going to go out and look up 2,000. I'm not going to spend hundreds of hours reading about all this tax law and all these tax cases. I don't care about it. I'll wait until somebody comes up to me with this UCC argument. Then I'll go look up the UCC argument in the literature and find out that it's bogus. That's what Beecraft did. When somebody says, this has been around for thousands of years, I'll go research it out and find out it doesn't even exist, not even for 1 year. It's totally fraudulent. That's what I'll do. That's what he did. And that's what all of these people should do, but they can't. So they rely upon their good friends. So when you have a good friend of yours that comes up and says, Bob, look at this. I'm really excited. Let me explain this to you. And it sounds so logical. And your good friend Bob, you know, you like Bob. He's a good buddy. But Bob has been led down the primrose path. He's a plumber, for crying out loud. What the hell does he know about law? And you don't want to go to a lawyer. He's going to charge you $150 an hour. So you listen to your friend Bob, who's been listening to his friend Tom, who's been listening to his friend George, who's been going to some patriot meeting, who's been listening to some guru, who got this crap from someplace and is out here selling it to make money. That's the way he makes his living, selling crap. It's like selling bat guano. If you're going to put it on your roses, it's a good product. If you're going to use it in court, I think you'll be disappointed. So this flag issue, a currently popular argument is that the gold-fringed flag indicates the admiralty jurisdiction in court. That's true, it does. And the traffic court is an admiralty court. And you are the proper subject of the admiralty court because you got a driver's license and you're a sea captain operating your vehicle on a river of tar, steering it around islands and backing it up to docks and engaging in interstate commerce. What better court could you go to find an admiralty flag than an admiralty court like the traffic court? All traffic courts should have admiralty flags. In fact, all of our courts should have admiralty flags. They're all commercial. Of course there's an admiralty flag in there. It's an admiralty court because we Americans have abandoned and abolished our common law. Americans do not practice the common law. They practice commercial law. That's why you got a social security number, so that you can practice commercial law. That's why you work at General Motors. That's why George Bush and all of your politicians encourage you to get a job. Jobs, jobs, jobs. That's what Americans want. Income, income, income. Tax, tax, tax. That's what Americans want. There was a time in America when we didn't have an income tax. We didn't have income. We were practicing the common law. Now we practice admiralty law. We practice commerce. And of course you've got taxes. How the hell are you going to support this gigantic bureaucracy without taxes? Come on, guys. Let's grow up and get real. Now, if you don't want to pay this tax, stop having income. Guy asked me one time, he says, how do you live without income? And I said, very well. Thank you. Very well. My great-granddad didn't have income. He dealt in property. Property, property rights. Property, the opposite to profit. I know it's kind of wild. Increase, the opposite to income. Tithe, the opposite to tax. I mean, we Americans used to practice that. And when we did, we got a result that came from it. And when we changed our law, when we changed our God and we changed our law, we got a different result. And that's where we are today. So on this flag issue over here, Vela versus McCammon, 671 Fed Supplement, 1128. And McCann versus Greenway, 952 Fed Supplement, 647. Sadler versus Payne, 974 Fed Supplement, 1411. There's three cases out of six on the flag issue. So you can't come into court and use the fringed flag as a defense for not paying your income tax. I mean, that's just where reality is located. Hey, we're out of time again. You know, when you're having fun, time flies. So I got to leave it right there. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard 7 days a week worldwide on the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, just go to our webpage, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact discs. So for more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.